This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, where a 529 plan can help meet your college savings goals. Details at putnam.com. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Car makers were on their best behavior, showing up in hybrids, saying all the right things, but I think it's fair to say they got a skeptical reception on Capitol Hill today. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Constellation Energy, working to provide responsible, sustainable energy to power America's future. Constellation Energy, the way energy works. And by Constant Contact, the email marketing service dedicated to helping small businesses and nonprofits succeed. ConstantContact.com.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Thursday, today the 4th of December. Great to have you with us. It was a more humble collection of auto industry CEOs that came calling on Congress this morning. Last time, of course, they were sent home with stern warnings to come back better prepared. Today, they did, but the jury is still out on whether that's going to get them the money they need. From Washington Marketplace's Nancy Marshall Genzer reports.
Talk about inflation. 2 weeks ago, the automakers asked Congress for $25 billion. Today, they told the Senate Banking Committee they needed $34 billion. Republican Richard Shelby of Alabama complained about the high price tag, and he said the automakers' restructuring plans were too vague.
If you made this presentation to get a bank loan, I suspect that any sensible banker would summarily dismiss your request.
But much of the Senate hearing focused on how to get money to the automakers, not whether they deserved it. Should the Fed step in? New York Democrat Charles Schumer suggested creating an auto czar to oversee any federal funding. Schumer asked GM CEO Rick Wagner what he thought of that.
Would you agree with this kind of model?
It would be very helpful for us to have someone to work with on this.
Helpful? To have a czar peering over your shoulder? Yes, Wagner said. Bring it on. Chrysler CEO Bob Nardelli and Ford CEO Alan Mulally chimed in. A czar would be fine with them, too. They also agreed to an oversight board. Morningstar auto analyst Dave Whiston says the CEOs may have to agree to more oversight, but it could complicate things.
You have to trust the management of the companies and loan them the money and let them be the experts that they are in running an auto company and not force them to go through an extra layer of oversight.
But Congress has its own overseers, the voters. In a recent CNN poll, 61% of those surveyed opposed bailing out the automakers. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall Genzer for Marketplace.
There is an interesting side note to the hearings today. Banking Committee Chairman Chris Dodd had apparently wanted some familiar faces at the witness table. But both Fed Chairman Ben Bernanke and Treasury Secretary Henry Paulson had prior engagements, which didn't sit too well with Senator Dodd.
The Secretary of Treasury is in China right now. It's time to come home. We got a serious problem on our hand, and I realize he's got a meeting over there, but we need him here, and I need the Federal Reserve to step up as well.
The Treasury Department, as it happens, is the other big story of the day. Today, there are reports Secretary Paulson has decided to do something about the housing market. That's an area he has been reluctant to get too involved with. So far, it's mostly informed speculation, but the details go something like this. Use Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac to push down mortgage rates for new home purchases, down as low as 4.5%. Marketplace's Steve Henn reports.
So here's the deal. A couple of weeks ago, the interest rate on a 30-year fixed-rate mortgage was about 6.5%. But then last week, the Fed said it planned to inject $500 billion into the mortgage market. This promise of a huge cash infusion pushed mortgage rates down almost a full percentage point. So if you were in the market for a sunny little three-bedroom, all of a sudden your monthly payments are looking much smaller. And now, someone inside the Treasury Department thinks rates should go even lower. The rumor is they want homebuyers to pay just 4.5%.
It would stimulate demand for sure.
Tom LaMalfa is a mortgage industry economist at Wholesale Access.
An interest rate like that is lower than we've ever seen in the history of American mortgage finance.
But there's a catch. Keith Gumbinger at HSH Associates says it looks like these low rates would be available only for qualified buyers and not families trying to refinance.
How many good credit quality borrowers with a down payment, with good credit scores, are actually interested in buying a house? I mean, how many people would actually be helped by this program?
And Gumbinger says rates could only stay this low for a limited time, which means in a few years, if you wanted to sell that cute little three-bedroom, you'd need a buyer who is willing to pay more each month than you are to borrow the same amount of money and live in the very same home. Or you could sell it for a loss. In Washington, I'm Steve Henn for Marketplace.
Nothing is simple about the housing market in this country, least of all how the Treasury's plan might work or whether it's going to work at all. So we've called somebody who can help us figure all that out. Susan Wachter is a professor of real estate at the University of Pennsylvania. Professor, good to have you with us.
Pleasure.
As you just heard Steve Henn tell us, the Treasury Department is thinking about trying to get mortgage rates down quite a bit to 4.5%. How are they going to do that?
The concept is to use Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, which are there to bring capital to the housing market and to use the Treasury working with Fannie and Freddie to get the rates down lower.
How exactly are Fannie and Freddie going to work together to get those rates down, though?
You know, if they have the cheap funding, and right now Fannie and Freddie are under conservatorship, they're the federal government entities. If the Treasury makes the funds available and directs that the rates come down, it will happen.
As I understand it, this program is for new buyers of homes that are on the market. It wouldn't do anything for people who want to refinance to get out from under mortgages they can't afford anymore. So if I have it right, that wouldn't really fix the foreclosure problem we have, would it?
No, it will not fix it. It will indirectly help it because part of the problem is that people who can't make payments on their loans can't sell their homes either. So if we expand the home ownership base and some of those homes that have no choice but to go into foreclosure, they can be sold. And that, of course, is a win-win. So it's not a direct response to the foreclosure problem, but it will ease it up.
Doesn't it, though, sort of get us to where we were getting into this crisis in the beginning, which is people who perhaps should not have had homes getting into them in the first place?
Absolutely. Overly liberal lending standards, erosion of lending criteria was a key problem. But this would be not those crazy no down payments, no stated income. And the qualifications for a loan will remain pretty conservative. So it's not going to go to all potential buyers by any means. In that sense, it will be rather constrained.
Much has been written that mortgages and fixing the housing problem are at the root of an eventual economic recovery. Do you think this finally is going to do it?
Absolutely not. This is part of the solution. This will help in getting the housing market back to stability. But the problem still remains that overhang of foreclosures, which has its own dynamic of driving down prices, which leads to more foreclosures. That, too, has to be addressed and directly.
All right. So what do you do when Henry Paulson calls you and says, Professor Wachter, help us out? What else can we do?
Well, there's a whole series of potential plans that are out there. Shale Bear has a plan, the FDIC. It's going to require that some pain is accepted all around. The current loans are simply unaffordable. These loans that were made a few years ago at rates that people simply could not pay back. So the lenders will have to adjust the terms.
Susan Wachter, professor of real estate and finance at the Wharton School at the University of Pennsylvania. Thanks very much.
My pleasure.
You want a market story today? Yeah, stocks had some action, but bonds were really the place to be. Yields on Treasury notes fell to the lowest we've seen in 50 years. That is what you call a flight to safety, gang. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. On top of fixing the economy, getting out of Iraq, and maybe overhauling this country's healthcare system, Barack Obama says he wants to invest billions of dollars in a clean energy infrastructure. For some pointers, he might look here at California. This state hopes to generate about a third of its electricity from renewable sources by 2020. But it's learning some difficult lessons along the way, because it turns out that building the capacity to generate more renewable energy, whether that's a solar grid, new wind turbines, or geothermal, that's reasonably easy. The hard part is tying all that new green power into the existing grid. From the Marketplace Sustainability Desk, Sam Eaton reports.
Once you start talking about powering a third of California's $2 trillion economy with renewable energy, solar panels on rooftops no longer cut it. Bob Lyden is with Sterling Energy Systems.
In order to get the type of megawatts or gigawatts worth of power that are required to meet these standards, you really need to go to large-scale solar. I mean, we're talking real industrial-scale solar.
And to do that, you need to travel hundreds of miles inland from the sprawling coastal cities to places like California's Imperial Valley. Lyden says this sun-baked stretch near the Mexican border is poised to become the Saudi Arabia of solar.
This is one of the best solar resources in the world. They get less than 2 inches of rain a year here, so there are not very many cloudy days.
Lyden wants to build acres of giant mirrors that concentrate the sun's heat enough to power steam turbines. Unlike conventional solar panels, solar thermal technology, as it's called, is expected to be cost competitive with coal in just over a decade. And once completed, this single plant could supply clean electricity to hundreds of thousands of homes in San Diego and Los Angeles. The only problem is getting it there. Jackie Fannin-Steele chairs the California Energy Commission.
The places where the renewables are most abundant are places where we haven't traditionally had power plants.
California has at least 80 large-scale solar projects on the drawing board. To tap into that power, it needs to start building transmission lines at an unprecedented pace and cost. But cost isn't what's holding up new projects.
The power lines will desecrate the open desert. It will desecrate the remote backcountry wilderness.
At a public hearing last week, in Imperial County, community groups and environmentalists rallied against a new power line that would cross fragile public lands.
You're going through Anzabrigo Desert State Park in South County as well.
Opposition to these projects is nothing new, especially in a state where nearly every view is dotted with high-voltage towers. But California's time frame for renewable energy is new. And with transmission lines taking up to a decade to approve, Governor Schwarzenegger has taken policymakers to task.
In a few minutes, I will be signing an executive order right over here to clear the red tape for renewable projects like solar, wind, and geothermal. We will streamline the permitting process and the siting of new plants and transmission lines.
At a recent news conference, Schwarzenegger singled out a solar farm in Victorville being held up because it sits on habitat for endangered squirrels.
It's just one of those unfortunate things that environmental regulations were holding up environmental progress.
And with half of all states now pushing renewable energy standards of their own, all eyes are on California and whether it can successfully fast-track one environmental goal without sacrificing another. Again, Jackie Fannin-Steele with the California Energy Commission.
We are, if you will, the beta test for the country on what can be done on renewables. And we're going to succeed here, and others are going to export that success.
But success isn't going to be easy. The Imperial Valley is also a mecca for off-roaders who worry about losing access to public lands. Bob Lyden's proposed solar farm would stretch across 10 square miles. But Lyden says for every naysayer, there's a supporter. Imperial County, for example, hopes a wave of green jobs will remedy its long-standing double-digit unemployment rate.
It's a balancing act. Like everything else, there's compromises, and you just really have to try to figure out what makes sense.
Lyden says if we're really serious about stopping global warming, it's not going to happen by making everyone happy. In California's Imperial Valley, I'm Sam Eaton for Marketplace.
As of right now, the new stadium that's being built for baseball's New York Mets is still going to be called Citi Field. In far better times, which were like 2 years ago, Citigroup paid $400 million for 20 years' worth of naming rights. Both sides say the government bailout of the bank isn't going to change things. And that makes the Mets one of the few professional franchises getting good news in the middle of a recession. Other sports aren't so lucky, and Diana Nyad is here to talk about that. Hi, Diana.
Kai, how are you?
I'm all right, but there are some in the sporting world not doing so well. What sports are in trouble, do you
think? Well, I guess you could say the whole world isn't doing too well, but in the sports world, it's the way I like to put it is it's the sports that use expensive toys.
that's
so
a good one.
That would be NASCAR, Formula One, America's Cup sailboat racing, golf. Those are the ones that are really hurting and looking at drastic cutbacks over the next couple of years.
Let's talk about the ones that are big in this country, because as much as everybody likes a good sailboat race and a Formula One race, really it's NASCAR and golf in this country specifically.
Yeah, that's right. Well, NASCAR, I mean, they're going to go all the way. They're going to cut back their season this coming year. They're going to cut back how many cars each garage can run.
Huh.
The big fancy, you know, garages with lots of money run 3 or 4 cars all year. They're going to cut back to 1 or 2. The crews, you can walk down those garages the last couple of years and see 50 guys, 50 in one garage. Unnecessary. They all realize that now. They can operate it at a third that number. They're going to cut down the weekend. Instead of doing testing on Thursday, qualifying on Friday, they're going to cut down to 1 day. Forget the testing. Forget the qualifying. Just get in and race. So NASCAR is going to be a very different animal.
And what about golf? I mean, we've talked about this before, you and I. They're losing some bank sponsorships.
Yeah, I mean, the LPGA, the women's side, is really in more desperate straits than the men. They have no network TV deal at the moment. A third of their tournaments are up for renewal in 2009, and already Hawaii, South Carolina, Phoenix, Tulsa, they're begging for even low-ball sponsorship dollars on that. They've got nothing. The PGA, the men's side, mm-hmm. their tournaments are pretty much intact for 2009, but a number of their title sponsor contracts expire in 2010. So 2009 is going to be a year of beating the pavement. I mean, Wachovia was a huge PGA sponsor. They're still going to have their tournament in Charlotte, but it probably won't be called the Wachovia anymore. So golf is under transition, and every meeting is just tightening that belt more and more and more.
By the same token, though, if you look at the National Football League, stadiums are full. Baseball's doing okay. Basketball pretty well, too, I suppose.
Well, let's start with the NFL. I would say it's the only sport I wouldn't call them entirely immune from this recession, but, you know, they are touting, you know, wonderful attendance records. Their licensed goods are selling at a very high rate. Their season tickets are pretty good. The only thing that I could find they've cut back on is that they offered playoff tickets for the coming playoff season at reduced rates. Now, the NBA cut back 9% of their front office workforce. That was about 80 jobs, so it's not as severe as General Motors, but, you know, no, they're definitely looking at cutting back. They shortened their preseason tournament schedule. Like most of us, I think the analogy for baseball and the NBA is they're doing fine. They're healthy. They're paying their bills. But like most of us, they're looking at every little extra dollar that
right.
they can cut.
Diana Nyad and the Business of Sports. Thanks, Diana.
Kai Rizdahl, thank you.
Coming up, no one is spared in a crumbling economy.
So we have to take a much more global view and a much more nuanced view about the fact that there are poor and the rich and that there are vulnerable and non-vulnerable. These issues require explicit attention.
But first, let's do the numbers. Remember when lower energy prices used to be good news? Well, that's not how Wall Street saw it today, as the Dow Industrial slid 215 points, 2.5%. The blue chips closed at 8,376. The NASDAQ deducted 46 points, just over 3%, to end at 1,445. The S&P 500 shed 25 points, a little shy of 3% there, wrapped up at 845. Weakening energy stocks greased the skids after a Merrill Lynch analyst predicted oil could fall below $25 a barrel next year. Crude prices have already dropped $100 since July to just under $44 today, and average U.S. gasoline prices are now below $1.80 a gallon, the lowest in nearly 4 years. On the other hand, profit margins for gasoline actually improve as the price goes down. That helped contain the losses at bigger companies with refining operations. ExxonMobil fell around 3%. Chevron shares lost close to 4% today. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Vanguard, offering investments designed to help individuals, institutions, and advisors reach their long-term financial goals. 888-VANGUARD. By Shriners Hospitals for Children, providing treatment for orthopedic, burn, and spinal cord injuries at no cost to the families. More at shrinersforkids.org. And by Gather.com. If it's happening in the world, it's being discussed on Gather.com.
people are talking about the economy at Gather.com. Want more from Marketplace's special Fallout coverage? It's all on our website. You'll find special podcasts, videos, and the Marketplace Decoder, a simple guide to financial terms and products. Go to marketplace.org.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Friday. In Washington, the Labor Department releases unemployment numbers for November. The Federal Reserve reports on consumer credit for October. And the CEOs of the big three automakers continue discussions on Capitol Hill. They meet with the House Financial Services Committee to review plans to stabilize the auto industry. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. We're going to continue now with Taking Stock, our occasional conversations with individuals who can give us the longer view of our present economic situation. All the trouble we're in might have started in the United States, but it sure hasn't ended here. Europe and Asia are trying to control their own crises, and the problems have reached into smaller, more vulnerable economies in places like Africa as well. Amartya Sen won the Nobel Prize 10 years ago for his work in welfare economics. He teaches economics and philosophy now at Harvard University. Professor Sen, welcome to the program.
Oh, thank you very much.
At this time of such great economic uncertainty in this world, is there one thing that you feel we should be paying greater attention to?
Well, I think the uncertainties affect different people very differently. People who are already vulnerable are affected dramatically more than others. The vulnerable are part of the society who often don't get their attention. I mean, even in the rescue packages, the concentration has been so much on bailing out the relatively more prosperous. So I think the prior susceptibility is a very important consideration. And the other is, I think, there is a new kind of understanding that's emerging about the balance between market and the state. But the fact of the matter is there are limits to what market can do as well as limits to what the state can do. I think the kind of crisis that we're going through now would have some educational value if we did learn something from it.
Kind of an expensive lesson, isn't it, though?
Certainly. Oh, yes. I'm not recommending it as a method of education. No. The fact of the matter is that we are in this mess, and we have to pull ourselves out of that, and the question of vulnerability and susceptibility is a way and means of doing it. But my second point about learning some lessons is to look at the future, because this is not the last time we may face a crisis of this kind.
Who, then, do you think is the most vulnerable in this case?
Well, vulnerable, depending on which country you're in. If you're looking at the United States, employment is a very big factor, more than in Europe, for example, where if you're unemployed, you have a longer unemployment insurance, you have health insurance, which covers you. Now, if it is the case, as indeed the case in this country, that you don't have automatic health insurance and that unemployment benefits could easily run out, that would certainly be a source of great vulnerability. But there's also a whole lot of people whose interests are not often looked at, namely people with disability, for example. And I think that kind of a question is extremely important, even though the numbers involved may not be a majority. But these are people who have intense suffering.
What about the wider world, though? Is this financial crisis setting up increased conflict and stress between the West and the developing world?
I don't think it's quite doing that. I think there are two things it's doing. One is bringing out the interdependence, that the American market collapse is influencing the life of people across the world in a way that brings out how, in some ways, indivisive our interests are. If you look at the poorer parts of the world, there are those which are relatively dynamic at this time, like China, India, Brazil, and so on. And they are affected, of course, because quite a lot of their economy depends on export. But they are already in a kind of high growth path. On the other hand, there are a lot of vulnerable people in China and India who from the reduction of that growth would suffer, because they're very dependent on public expenditure of various kinds. But then there's a whole lot of other countries in Africa, for example, where they are not having that kind of a dynamic economy. On the other hand, they will get the downturn, and things may get much worse for a whole lot of people. So I think the fact of the matter is that our fortunes are always divided, and nothing brings out our divisions as much as a situation of crisis like we are seeing today.
What's the role for some of the international economic organizations, like the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund, at times like these?
Well, I think that's a big question. I think we are trying to look at a kind of different way of seeing at the world. After all, these institutions were basically set up in the 1940s, when pretty much all of Africa and much of Asia were colonial territories. So we have to take a much more global view and a much more nuanced view about the fact that there are poor and the rich, and that there are vulnerable and non-vulnerable. These issues require explicit attention. We need a change of perspective which goes, and I can't emphasize it enough, with what I see as global democracy, by which I don't mean a global government. Democracy basically has always meant active public reasoning. John Stuart Mill's phrase, government by discussion, is extremely important. And the global organizations have a huge role to play in that.
What's the right thing for the big economies to do, for the United States and Europe to do? Should we fix our own problems first and then turn our attention to what's going on in the developed world? Or should we try to keep an eye on both areas and try to do what we can for countries like Brazil and Russia and India and China and some of the even poorer countries too?
Kai, I think absolutely the latter, with a slight modification. I must say I've never been a believer in one thing at a time. No economic policy can be run like that. But when it comes to fixing one's own house, there's no question that America fixing its own house, and I hope that under new administration that will happen rapidly, will help the world. There's no question. But there's at the same time the issue about not overlooking the plight of the distressed, whether it be the Chinese poor or the Indian poor. But I would even give less concern on that, because after all, these countries are in some ways able to deal with them within reason. But there's a whole lot of countries whose interests may not be so well looked after. I would tend to emphasize that.
Amartya Sen, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
Amartya Sen won the Nobel Memorial Prize in Economics in 1998. You can hear more from our series, Taking Stock, on our website. It's marketplace.org.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, managing nearly $8 billion in municipal bond assets. Details at putnam.com. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note, a little bit of tomorrow's news today. We're going to get the November unemployment report in the morning. By almost every estimate, it's going to be unpleasant. 200,000 jobs lost at least, along with a commensurate bump in the unemployment rate. That'll put the economy down almost 1.5 million jobs so far this year. And remember, that's not counting layoffs that were announced today. DuPont and AT&T, both components of the Dow, said they're going to be cutting 18,000 workers between them. And that is Marketplace from American Public Media for this Thursday. Today, the Dow dropped 215 points, 2.5%. The NASDAQ lost 46 points. That's more than 3%. The S&P 500 fell 25 points, just shy of 3% there. Stephen Gregory, John Haas, Patty Hirsch, Betsy Streisand, and Lisa Tucker are the Marketplace editing staff. The managing editor is George Judson. Coming up next time on the program, big cutbacks at work are a big-time bummer.
I was putting in more hours, and then I realized, what's the point, really?
Dude. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.